Hello, welcome back to Channel 9 Studios. We're doing ASPConf. We're doing an Ask the Experts session. I'm Brad Wilson.
Damien Edwards.
And Marcin Dobosz.
And we are here to answer expert level questions about SignalR, ASP.NET MVC, and ASP.NET Web API. And I have, for the last couple of days, I've been collecting questions from the community, so we have some pre-canned questions. If you want to tweet questions at us, you can use the hashtag CH9Live. Also, obviously, we have the Jabber chat room, which is ASPConf-CH9. Ask a question, either one of those, and hopefully our stalwart people will be monitoring those for questions and then share those with us later. So without further ado, let's get started with the first question. So this is kind of, this is two questions, obviously. So the first one is, you know, to serve HTML or JSON depending on request, would you use MVC and format the model depending on the request type? Second one is it possible to use Web API to render views? So the question's really about, you know, how do I decide whether I'm going to use Web API or MVC, you know, if I have data that is JSON or HTML? So this is kind of a both a Web API and MVC question. Martin, what are your thoughts?
Well, right now, it's kind of difficult to serve HTML from Web API just because we don't have the ability to run Razor as nicely as we do from MVC.
Right.
So we're kind of in this position where Web API is really nice for JSON, MVC is nice for JSON, but really nice for HTML.
Right.
We hope to address that in the future, and there's been some work on the you know, from the community about running Razor views inside of Web API, for example, using the Razor generator project.
Right.
And so you can definitely do that. It's not going to have as much of the nice ASP.NET compilation happening, but it's definitely a possibility.
And I think I have a link for that. Let's pop up in the browser. So I believe that this comes from... you can do some of this with a formatter. So the community, like the
right.
Web API contrib community, has this idea of a Razor formatter, right? Formatters in Web API are the thing that converts your data into whatever final representation is going to be, JSON, XML. So Frederick Norman, who's one of the more active people in the Web API community, has this great blog post about ways that you can return Razor from within your Web API.
Yeah.
That said, I mean, when I do the elevator pitch for MVC versus Web API and people say, you know, why would I use one or the other, I tend to say that MVC's strength, I guess you would say, is taking informed data and returning HTML. Web API's strength is taking in and returning structured data.
Right.
So yep. I don't really see anything wrong with using both. The one time it becomes difficult to use both is if you want to self-host, right? Because MVC
right.
doesn't self-host. So... let's see. Any thoughts?
Nothing more and
nothing
further to what you have added as the experts in Web API and MVC.
Okay.
So.
So this is kind of a related question, which is, would you use MVC to return JSON?
You can.
Yeah.
We've supported it for a while now, and it still totally works. I guess it once again depends on the exact scenario that you're trying to accomplish. You know, if you are just trying to send, well, if you're building an API, like a real web API, then that communicates using JSON, then, well, Web API is probably the best suited for that. If you just want, you know, some backing stored data for your autocomplete dropdown in a search box or something like that, then, well, an MVC JSON result is probably all that you need, really.
Yeah.
So if that's all you need, yeah, keep using MVC's JSON support.
Yeah, and there's we're not going to take the JSON stuff away from MVC, right? So you can continue to use it. It does work. So there's no sense converting Web API just for that.
Yeah.
But if you're going to make a full-blown API for your app,
right.
then maybe consider Web API. And in some of these things where you're doing JSON today in MVC, you could move those over
start
opportunistically.
Start calling your API instead of custom actions on your MVC controller,
right?
And have that serve HTML.
Right. Okay.
Cool. What's next? Another one for you, Brad, maybe?
This is an MVC question. I think Marcin would be a good person to answer this.
Yeah.
So this is about scoping with action filters in MVC. So he wants his filter to run last, but he doesn't want to set order on every filter. Is that even necessary?
Well, it depends really where you register the filter. So there's two parts of this question. Is it possible to explicitly set the scope of an action filter? And I believe the answer is no, because, well, that's this particular class that the person that Ben is asking about doesn't have a scope property. That's something that gets orchestrated slightly outside of it when we build the chain of filters to execute. Now, the real question, it seems like, is, well, how do you order filters without setting order on each and every one? And, well, that's a bit more complicated. Well, one way you could do it is by having a derived filter class that sets the order property to some sufficiently high enough order such that they always run last.
Uh-huh.
You could also plug into the filter orchestration pipeline, which is implemented by iFilter providers, and alter that logic. And we have a number of filter providers that ship in MVC by default. There's the global one and the action/controller one. And so you could take one of those and subclass it or write a new one and replace the default registered one with your own implementation and, you know, solve this problem that way.
Okay.
That's how I would look at it, I think.
Another way you can sort of scope down the problem maybe is if, maybe it's not so much that you want to run last, maybe Ben really needs to run last, but maybe what the problem is you need to run after a particular other filter.
Yeah.
Right, so the mechanisms you suggested, you could certainly look through the filter list and make sure that filters end up ordered after each other. You could also use composition. You know, it's like if you're going to always use these two filters together, you can compose them into a third filter which does both,
right,
and make sure they both run in the right order.
Yeah, that's also true.
Yep. There's is there a similar filter concept in web forms yet?
Not now, but it's. I spoke in the two talks ago about some things that we're looking at doing out of band for web forms, and one of those is a set of data binding extensions.
Mm-hmm.
And with the support we added in 4.5 for model binding, we now have methods in your code behind file or in a separate class, if that's where you put them, that kind of end up looking a bit like action methods in MVC because they get invoked by the runtime and they get model bound values piped into them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of very similar. I said, well, wouldn't it be nice if I could have a logic that happens, you know, before the method is invoked and immediately after the method is invoked so that I could either shortcut the response or I could manipulate the values that are pumped in or manipulate the value returned. And so as part of the data binding extensions, as well as the async model binding I alluded to before, we're looking at supporting something like filters. So there would be model method filters that you'd be able to decorate a model method with and have it run just like an action filter.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Is that something you guys are going to be able to plug in out of the bot?
Yeah, it is. So we actually did. We made sure when we built model binding in 4.5 for web forms that all the extension points were public, so that you could quite easily replace all the logic out of bounds. So the, sort of the core unit, there is like the model binding system itself, which we quite literally lifted from the MVC Futures project, the extensible model binding stuff. And then the updates we made to the controls, we added a new model data source control and a model data source view. But you don't need to put them in your page. We create them on the fly for you and then attach them to the control.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a custom model data source view that you want to use, there's a single event you can handle on the control, and you give us that instead.
Yep.
And so that's where you would do this logic. So in the custom model data source and its sister model data source view, you get full access to the sort of method invocation pipeline. And you can. This is where we would hook in filters and async result processing and things like that.
Gotcha.
And I may cover some of that tomorrow in my web forms, advanced web forms talk.
Excellent. So we have our first question from the internet. I'm going to have to read this one to you because you can't see it. From B. Martin, SignalR is cool, but are there any large production use cases? I'm struggling to see the use beyond chat.
We get that question a lot. So yes.
Do you think it's because your showcase app is a chat app?
Possibly.
Probably.
So the way I like to say it is that any time in your application where you've ever set up AJAX polling, so you've ever called set interval or set timeout, get the result, call set timeout again. or any time a user has to hit F5 in your application because something has changed and the data on their screen is stale, that's a fantastic case for Signaler. That's exactly what it's designed to do. Right. So that they're sort of scenarios where I'm using an existing technology to try and get some element of real time into my application. The most arcane being the user hits F5. But then also Signaler, as well as sort of replacing those things, enables new scenarios that just aren't possible without something like Signaler. So for things that are truly real-time, where you need to stream down multiple packets of information per second so you can do things like real-time gaming and stuff like that in the browser, you really need that persistent connection type of abstraction.
So when is the first Signaler game going to come out?
So I know Fowler is working right now on a version of Bomberman, for Signaler, so he has it sort of running in HTML right now.
Not big space rocks?
Not big space rocks, no, not massive multiplayer big space rocks. And so his intent is to create a Signaler, scale-out version, sort of a Bomberman at the moment. I know other people have created prototypes. There's a really cool prototype that was created a while ago where you have two mobile phones and they play Pong against each other. And so you can literally put them down next to each other and the ball goes off the side of one screen and then comes onto the other screen.
That's
and you can
cool.
move it, which
That's
is kind of cool. And so, I mean, but for more sort of production use cases, when people think of like enterprise applications, another really great sample I saw was someone had an entity editing form. And I remember in organizations I've worked in, we had to create systems whereby multiple people could be editing the same record at the same time. And we would take pessimistic locks on records because we needed to do full change tracking. And then locks would time out. So they actually showed within the form, you'd have a field for each, like an HTML field for each of the fields on the entity. And it would show you in real time who was currently updating what field, which is kind of nice. So you can imagine that in a web scenario, you could be looking at a record, you start editing, and it would tell you in real time that this record has already changed, and here's the thing that's changed underneath you.
Right.
And then obviously you would have some merge logic or something like that.
I remember that one of the first applications that demoed Signaler was that drawing app where you had a bunch of people sharing a screen, and they could draw shapes in a browser. It was very rudimentary because it was just a demo, but that's one application.
Yeah.
Just off the top of my head, another one I can think of is a sort of mapping application. If you're running a fleet of vehicles, you could track their locations on the map in the browser in real time, getting updates.
We've actually seen a demo of that. Someone in Canada, I think, did it with a local fire station. And so he had a mapping application that would show incidents on the map in real time, and then vehicle dispatching and vehicle location because they had GPS tracking. That was kind of cool. Now, Phil is making fun of me now with his question, asking me, what is this data that Damien keeps speaking about? Data, for all those American people who don't understand my accent.
Say cash.
Cash.
No. Cash. No, say it how you said it this morning.
Cash.
Cash. He's wearing... People don't know this. He actually has a perfectly normal American accent.
I do.
He's wearing an Australian microphone.
It's an Australian microphone they gave me.
Filtering out and making him
sound
like
to put it through a translation filter or something.
Yeah. So, interestingly, Levi gave a demo this morning in our talk this morning about stock data. Mm-hmm. So there's another example of data that's periodically getting updated. I saw the guys back there who were... they're watching sort of the real-time statistics.
Yes.
What's going on in this conference, right? How many people are watching a video? How many people are on the website? And that kind of stuff, actually, it could also benefit from Signaler.
Absolutely.
Right? So you have nice real-time graphs and whatnot.
Yep, absolutely. So I don't see an end to the possibilities. I think you really have to flip your thinking. I mean, I think the reason we think of web applications they are now is because we've been limited by the tools that have been available to us.
Sure.
When you now start thinking the fact that I can just receive data from the server when it happens, you can start thinking of an infinite amount of things you could use it for.
And it actually makes us think about going back to the old way of client-server.
Yeah.
Right? We've treated our browsers very dumbly up until this
Absolutely.
Point for the most part. So
now we have rich.
We can start treating them like a real app.
Well, we have stateful, browsers now with beautiful HTML5 APIs. We have technologies like Knockout and, other JavaScript frameworks for maintaining state in the browser. And this whole idea of a single page application is becoming a lot more prevalent. So.
Right.
So let's move on to the next question.
Okay, how can I unit test views in the HTML they generate? Marches!
it's
your favorite topic.
The $60,000 and $64,000 questions, I don't know how much are these worth these days. Well, the answer is it's kind of hard. It really depends what kind of views you have. If you have ASPX views, well, they are built on top of the web forms engine that's part of core system web DLL, and those are kind of notoriously difficult to unit test, mainly because of their dependence on the HTTP context.current property and then just a bunch of things that are hard to mock. And Razor views are a bit easier in the sense that they're built on the abstractions layer that's also available in MVC. So at least you can mock a lot of these concepts and use something like Razor Generator to compile and run these views. However, I'd say that unit testing views is kind of hard to think of what unit testing would actually look like. A view can be, a pretty complicated templating thing that produces complicated output based on complicated inputs. So is it still even unit testing? I don't know. You write the unit test framework. If you have a view with a bunch of master pages and maybe composed out of some partials calling some other things, are we getting towards the world of more integration or scenario or
in one sense, right, the Robin Sandals Agile guy in me says it's not a unit test. But in another sense, a lot of people do call it a unit test because they're testing their app. And it might not necessarily think about it in terms of, a tester writing it or a developer writing it. Those are sort of unimportant distinctions in my mind, but there's a place for both kinds of tests, right? Mm-hmm. There's a place for those little tiny unit tests. There's a place for those end-to-end integration tests. I don't think personally of the view as a place to do unit tests. I mean, I think of it as when I unit test, I go right up to the glass. And what I mean when I say right up to the glass is I get right to the view and I stop just before I get there. Right? So I want to test my controllers. I want to test my services. I want to test all my filters and all that stuff, but the actual view itself, I leave that to exploratory testing or automated functional testing, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, and we've struggled with this notion of how do you test views for a long time now, and it's a hard problem, which is probably what explains why we haven't come up with a really good solution for it yet. How do you test the HTML output? You can do a string comparison and see if that matches, but if some designer comes in, tweaks a class name or something, suddenly all of your tests
start
failing.
It's the very definition of a brittle test, right?
It would be a very brittle test, so now you have to do more of a kind of a semantic analysis of what the data in there is and try to look up the third element under the fourth div tag and see if it, spells out the user's name or something like that.
Yeah.
But that itself also becomes brittle. Mm-hmm. So
interestingly, Web API with the option to self-host, we even have the idea that you can host in memory.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do these end-to-end tests in Web API really cheap and fast.
Right.
It'd be really cool if we had something like that for MVC.
We do have it for Signaler, I will say.
Oh,
so
cool.
Signaler has a .NET client, and it has obviously a server API, and you can self-host Signaler. And we mimicked the awesome design that Web API has with a client-server sort of API symmetry. Mm-hmm. So you can new up a new .NET Signaler client and pass in an instance of a server, essentially.
Right.
And then you can just run sort of connections back and forward all in memory for doing that type of testing,
right,
which is kind of nice.
Very nice.
So we've had another question from the field. We've got from Stilgar. With Signaler, how can I send different information to each client for one event? So that's a good question. So the scenario here is that I've set up maybe a Signaler persistent connection or a Signaler hub, and some event has taken place in my application, whether it's a user has pumped information into my app, or maybe a database is updated, or whatever it might be. But I now have data, but I want to transform that data into a different version to everyone who's currently connected. Well, the first thing you need to do is track connections. So by default, Signaler doesn't track connections. We're actually a loosely coupled pub-sub model sort of in the core. And so if you want to actually be able to keep track of individual users, which a lot of apps do, obviously, you need to keep track of that state in whatever state mechanism your application has. Mm-hmm. So if, for instance, in Jabber, which a lot of you will be using right now, that's running on Azure. It has backed by a SQL Azure database. And when you log into Jabber, Signaler gives us a connection ID, which is a GUID. And it says, OK, Damien has logged in as Damien Edwards via Twitter. So here is Damien Edwards, and here is the current GUID that represents that connection. And that data goes into the database. So then when someone tries to send me a direct message on Jabber, in which case I am actually sending different information to me because I'm sending a direct message to me, but it's just a room broadcast to everyone else because you can actually sort of do replies as well in Jabber. I get a specific message sent to me by looking up the connection ID that I'm currently associated with out of the database and doing a broadcast to me using the broadcast API by passing in my connection ID, and then I do a standard broadcast to everyone else.
Right.
So if you have a list of people who are currently logged in your database and you have that mapping to connections, then when an event comes in, you can literally for each over the current connections after you've retrieved it from your persistent mechanism and do whatever transform is necessary before you push that message out.
So there's events on the hub that can tell you when when people get connected and disconnected?
Exactly. So if you need to track connections, both of our sort of API layers have this. So persistent connection has it by default. There's a method you can override. There's three methods: on connect, on reconnect, and on disconnect. And on hubs, it's an opt-in model. So you decorate your hub class with an extra interface, which is iConnected, and then you have to implement those three methods, the connect, reconnect, and disconnect, and then from there, you can track what's going on.
We're going to hold off on that question because that question already got asked.
Ha. So one for you based on your NDC talk, Brad.
Yeah, so Knockout.js looks great. What's the impact on visitors using assistive technologies like screen readers? this is actually a significant problem. When we're doing JavaScript-based applications where the view might be generated inside of JavaScript, it might actually be difficult for a screen reader that doesn't have JavaScript to even render anything.
Yeah.
So a couple strategies that people tend to take in these scenarios are that probably the most common one is detecting the user agent of the screen reader and saying, well, because this is a screen reader, I'm just going to give a standard HTML style from the server, as opposed to demanding the browser generate things. And actually, it's not all that uncommon to use that technique anyway, because search engines have the same problem.
JavaScript running.
Or even when you take something that doesn't have search, doesn't have assistive technology, maybe like Gmail is another good example, where you have maybe you're on a system that's not powerful enough to run a JavaScript. Maybe it's too slow. You're running on a phone, so you end up doing a very standard HTML version of the application in addition to the JavaScript version. So I don't know that there's a perfect solution to this. I think you have to evaluate your users and figure out what's going to be the best.
So there's multiple approaches, I guess. I mean, you've touched on some of them. Progressive enhancement is sort of the big term that we've used for many years to talk about how to solve this before the advent of single-page applications. So the idea is you would serve your app as a base level, not requiring JavaScript, perhaps not even requiring CSS. So essentially, your app is fully functional for the core set of scenarios that you need to support just through HTML. And you have links that are just links off to other pages, or forms that are posts. And then you start layering on the extra sort of user experience functionality by attaching CSS to make it look nice, and then attaching JavaScript to add client-side behavior.
Sure.
Because you can take an anchor tag, which points to href/foo, and turn that into, when you click it, you perform some JavaScript operation that makes an AJAX request and then incorporates the result back into the page. So if you didn't have JavaScript, the navigation would work just perfectly well. And if you do have JavaScript, you can sort of merge it into the app. Now, obviously, that's a lot more work. But in the certain sites I've built using that sort of technique in the past, that type of site that we were building, it actually wasn't that much work, because we would do all the non-JavaScript version first, which means all the HTML is there, everything is there that's required to hook up that dynamic UI, and then you go and write the jQuery stuff afterwards to call into a slightly different endpoint, and this sort of goes into the question we had before about serving HTML versus JSON. You would hit a different endpoint with slightly different semantics such that it returns you JSON, and then you would do the whatever templating you want in the client. The other thing to note here is something called ARIA, A-R-I-A, which stands for the Accessible Rich Internet Application Standard. So you can actually mark up your DOM elements in such a way with extra attributes, ARIA-, and there's various attributes you can use, to give assistive technologies like screen readers extra information about what type of role an element is playing.
Right.
So you can say this element is a menu and it has this many elements and et cetera, et cetera. So when the screen reader is reading through the HTML, even if it's been dynamically generated by JavaScript, it can actually speak out loud to the user, telling them the type of UI that they're looking at.
I think the reality is that browsers have been making progress. I think screen readers will also make progress.
Yeah.
I actually think the days of screen readers not having JavaScript enabled are probably numbered.
Yes.
Because these applications are going to be far too compelling, and the cost is going to be too high to not have them there.
Right.
But if you, like you say, if you can do the semantic markup and use the ARIA tags to mark everything, then the readers will be able to take that dynamically generated HTML and do right things with it.
Yep, absolutely.
So, okay, next. Disposing resources and controllers when returning delayed stuff, especially iQueryable. So this is particular about web API. All right, so I know that in the early days of web API, we had this problem where the things that were disposed and the controllers disposed ended up getting disposed too early. And so, like, if you had database context, for example.
Right.
You have an
right.
iQueryable, which is an outstanding unissued database request. You can end up, you know,
right.
basically cutting your request off at the knees before you ever got any data.
Right. So, the point is you can't write using new DB context,
exactly.
open brace, close brace, return, you know, get the iQueryable, return it. By the time the iQueryable actually gets evaluated, the DB context has been disposed as
right.
part of the using semantics, and the iQueryable is no longer valid and will throw an exception when you try to evaluate it.
And in particular, you know, importance with the OData stuff, which we're going to talk about in a minute, like the OData query stuff,
right.
You definitely want to have the real iQueryable that hasn't actually been issued to the server yet.
Mm-hmm.
To do skip, top, sort, filter, you want to do all that stuff before it goes to the server.
Right.
Otherwise, you're pulling down tons more data than you need.
Right.
Filtering
right.
on, you know, filtering it on the web server instead of on the database is a really bad idea. So,
so
I believe that now dispose on controller, you added the
so
register
actually,
for dispose
yeah,
stuff,
we,
right?
Yeah, we have an extension method that I think hangs off of the HTTP request message object.
Mm-hmm.
It's called register for dispose. And what it does is you pass in an object, an iDisposable instance into it, and it will stash it into a collection of items that need to be disposed once the request has actually been finished being
nice.
Processed. And so once the final byte goes out the door, we iterate over that collection of items, and we just call dispose on all of them. So that's how you would do it.
Yeah,
you
know, anybody can use that extension method, right?
Yes.
Like if I'm a filter,
right.
and maybe the filter uses a database context and wants it to go away, it can call request.register for dispose and throw the database context in there, and we'll clean it up.
Nice. Yep, exactly. So yeah, as long as you have an HTTP request message instance, either through the various context objects that we provide throughout the framework, or just passed in as a parameter to the action method.
Right.
You can call that extension.
So that sounds like a fairly cheap way, but which is good. It's great that we've got that in the framework now. But
right.
I know a lot of people to date have used, say, features of an IRC container to do this for them as well. So you can
sure.
like set scope affinity for a particular resource that you resolve out of your IRC container, and then it'll take care of getting rid of it after that
right.
sort of thing takes place. So I guess you could still do something like that.
Yeah, and the new dependency injection stuff in Web API that went in very late. I don't remember if it was in RC or if it's going to come in RTM, but there's the new scoped dependency injection support for Web API.
Nice.
One of the big pieces of feedback we took from MVC, which had a very simplified version, which is just one container for the whole application. But now we have per request scope. So if you resolve something into scope and your DI container supports this idea of scope, then it'll automatically get cleaned up.
Oh, magnificent.
And strangely enough, we use that feature, the register for dispose, to register the scope for disposal because the scope is disposable.
Beautiful.
So yeah. It all came together.
Happy family.
Happy family.
All right. So this looks like a signaler question. So guidance on how many hubs to use at once in light of browser and or server connection limits. So the way hubs currently work in Signaler is that you create a server class that represents your hub, the hub being a place that many clients come and connect to. And then in the client, you get this object automatically sort of pushed into the JavaScript world by way of that magic tag that you add into your page through to /signaler/hub. So we generate you a JavaScript file, and we give you objects that represent the hubs on the server. Under the covers, what actually happens is we implicitly create for you in the JavaScript client a new Signaler connection. So just as if you'd gone $.connection and passed in a URL and created your own persistent connection, we do that and we call that the hub connection. And there is one hub connection over which all hub traffic flows.
Mm-hmm.
And so all those hub properties that hang off $.connection, so if you have a hub called chat hub, you'll be able to go $.connection.chathub on the client. The traffic for that flows over the hub connection, and that's represented by $.connection.hub. And that's why in all the hub demos, you'll see you have to say $.connection.hub.start to start that one connection over which all hub traffic flows. And so you can have as many hubs as you like, and you're only going to be using a single persistent connection between the client and the server, which is why we did it that way. Now, that said, in the next version of Signaler we're going to release in 0.5.3, we've introduced a new slightly lower level of hub support in JavaScript. So in the .NET API for hubs in the client, we have the ability to actually create a hub connection, which is a special derived type of connection in the client, which only knows how to talk to hub connections on the server. And so you create the hub connection, then you ask the hub connection to generate a proxy for you. And you get back an object over which you can call an invoke method, and you pass it a string of a method you want to invoke on the server. Or you can register a callback by way of an on method saying when this hub event takes place, so on data available, run this callback. Mm-hmm. And then we've rebuilt the magic sort of hub proxies on top of this new lower level. And you can have as many of those hub connections as you like. So you can go right into the client and new up five hub connections, and the browser will actually make five separate requests. And that's when you're going to start getting into browser limits. And so by default, most browsers, modern browsers, will support about six concurrent requests to the same host, mm-hmm. And IE6 Longitude 2. And so that's, again...
Do you guys support IE6?
We do support IE6.
Awesome.
Yeah, yeah. It just works.
So one hub and whatever, like right, second connection for future use.
For images and stuff, that are other right things that need to be downloaded for your app. Yeah. Or for the AJAX send, because it's another channel. And so, yeah, so we've now, in the next version, we're going to have this, the existing stuff will still be there, but we've completely rewritten it under the covers how it works. So the existing stuff will still use one connection, which is $.connection.hub, and all your hub traffic will flow over that, unless you want to take control of the hub connections, which you can do by saying $.hub connection instead of $.connection. You can create a hub connection, you can generate a proxy manually, and then use sort of this late-bound sort of string-based API instead to do that. So server connection limits... again, it's just going to come down to what your app's doing. But as I said, if you're using the dynamic hub stub that we do, the dynamic hub proxy stuff we do for you, you're only using a single connection.
So what would your guidance here now? This is talking about hubs, but if you're using the connection API, which is sort of lower level
yes
API of SignalR, are you just, you're sort of stuck having to do the same thing for yourself, right?
Yeah, I would
make
say
one connection,
do one.
And all your traffic goes across
yes
it.
I mean, I don't think it's any different for doing than doing basic socket programming too. If you had a rich client, you were doing socket programming, generally you'll connect to a single server unless you're doing like crazy peer-to-peer type stuff. But this is a mm-hmm web browser at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And so we still have to be mindful of the environment we're running in. So general guidance, create a single connection back to the endpoint and flow your data over that.
Okay. Great. Ooh, complete rewrite of MVC. I don't even have to look at the rest of the quote. I already want to say yes.
It's been 3 years, 4 years now.
It's time to do a rewrite.
It's crap. It's crap now. Anything that's 4 years old is crap.
Yep.
no, I'm kidding. It's awesome. Is a complete rewrite of MVC possible to make it truly async from top to bottom would ever be considered? There's a little bit of a misnomer here about MVC not being async from top to bottom. I think in MVC 3, actually it might have been MVC 4, basically the entire pipeline is async.
Yes.
Right.
But what's not async is a lot of the extensibility points,
right,
filters and whatnot. And we actually fixed that in Web API. If you look at the low-level extensibility points, they're all pretty much that exact same signature of here's a request message and here's a cancellation token, give me back a task of response message, so everything's async by default.
Right.
You want to do this? You want to rewrite MVC?
Sure, yeah. Give me a weekend and it's done. Yeah, I mean, as mentioned, yeah, MVC already runs asynchronously. Filters won't be asynchronous. The main thing that isn't asynchronous right now, actually, is the database itself. At least if you're using Entity Framework, a popular choice, you know, that guy doesn't support async.
Although I believe Scott mentioned earlier today that in EF6, there will be async support.
Yeah.
I did see that.
Yeah, I heard that as well. So in the future, that kind of major hurdle will go away, and so I guess we'll have to rewrite MVC then to take advantage of it.
Better put
it
on the backlog.
And there's a related question that nobody asked, but I've been asked at conferences, which is, you know, people see Web API and you see the self-host in Web API and say, how can I do that with MVC?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is you can't.
Not easily.
I mean, not easily. there are things you can do, but the reality is it's not easy. So there's always been a hosting API at the bottom of ASP.NET for a long time, maybe even
from at least two. Yes.
This idea, like, if starting with Visual Studio 2005, we started shipping this web server that we call Cassini.
Yeah.
But if you run, you know, your web apps in 2005, 2008, even 2010, and there's that little radio button on the web tab that says, you know, run it in a development web server instead of IIS. So that's the thing we call Cassini. It's actually using the hosting APIs that have been in ASP.NET for a long time. It would be an interesting prospect to me to see exactly how much of this stack we could get running without losing the ASP.NET intrinsics and all the compatibility of MVC. Because clearly one way you could do a rewrite is just say, well, throw everything away, and you get to use HTTP request message, HTTP response message. And that would be a nice new MVC framework, but your existing apps wouldn't work.
Wouldn't work at all, yeah.
So there's a lot of
apps are all of the extensions that people have built on top of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's actually the more important part, right? It's like your controllers probably don't interact with the intrinsics all that much. They shouldn't really. But all the machinery that you depend on, especially the third-party plugins, are probably all going to depend on that stuff being there.
All of your logging, filtering, So
this would be this would be a good interview question.
It would be.
somebody came and said, I've used MVC for a long time. Okay, what would you do if you could rewrite it? What would you change?
Yes.
Like, I think we already know one thing we would change, right? The model binding stuff.
Yeah.
Webforms took Levi's new model binding stuff, so did Web API.
Yes.
So it's like one of those things we said, well, it was almost right.
They kind of do this,
It was almost right, And it is funny that that does seem to be what they do.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. So this is from our good friend Brady. I would love to see an end-to-end example of getting WCAT, that's a web capacity analysis tool, running with Crank and Flywall. So this is a Signaler question. And wouldn't you know it, I have come prepared. So let's do a very abbreviated walkthrough of what it means. So I showed this at NDC, and I showed it at TechEd, and where I load test a Signaler application, our Flywheel. A Flywheel is our performance harness for Signaler that we use when we do performance testing. And I drive load using this tool called WCAT. WCAT is something the IIS team put out. I should actually have that loaded up already. So just so to find it, I went to Google, you can go to Bing, whatever, and search for WCAT 64-bit. Because if you search for WCAT, what you'll get by default is the x86 version, and you'll see that there's no result there for the 64-bit version. And I'm assuming that most people now on their servers, at least, are running 64-bit. Mm-hmm. And so search for the 64-bit version so that you get 6.3x64.
So to be clear, for the people who are maybe not familiar with this tool, but maybe they've used some of the Apache tools, this is kind of like AB, the Apache benchmark?
Yes, it is.
You basically fire a bunch of traffic at the website and see what happens.
And it's been around for a long time. It's actually used by the Perf Labs here. Our own ASP.NET and IIS Perf Lab use this tool.
Right.
It's a completely native tool. It uses almost no memory. It scales like crazy. And it even has very complicated stuff where you can set up a controller machine and then multiple physical clients which are driven from the controller. And then each physical client machine emulates virtual clients, like thousands of virtual clients. So once you've downloaded this and installed it, nothing happens. Like, nothing works by default. What you then have to go and do, and this is why people sort of struggle with this thing, is go into your C drive, go into Program Files, go to WCAT. Now, again, 64-bit, so Program Files on my 64-bit, and there's a doc folder. And there is a WCAT.doc. And this is extremely good documentation. It's actually a very, very large document.
It's updated 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's about 60 pages. But the very thing you want to the thing you want to look for is setting up a test environment. Quick start, here it is. Running WCAT and installing WCAT. So if I come through to this, these are the steps that most people get hung up on. So after you've installed WCAT, you need to go to a command line and run a bunch of things before WCAT will even work properly. So go to the documentation, look for installing WCAT. Once you've installed it, do what it says here. Open a command prompt and navigate to the installation directory. Run Cscript, which is the Windows console scripting host, and set its default host to Cscript. Because sometimes if you run a Windows scripting file, it'll try and run it using the WScript host, the Windows scripting host. And it's a completely different environment. It has different variables, it has different objects. So you need to set the default environment to Cscript. So that's the first one. Then you go ahead and actually run the WCAT.wcf. So this is a script file that you're now going to run, which will load using Cscript. And you pass in these variables here, dash terminate, dash update, dash clients. Don't copy and paste from here. So this is the other problem. If you copy and paste from here, this is not a standard hyphen. This is a word hyphen.
Don't do that.
And similarly, if you go and search for this, Hanselman actually has a really good blog post. And he has, I think it was the Node IIS blog post. So here we go. He has a section in here about using WCAT. Here it is. And so if you try and copy-paste that line, it also won't work.
Because
He also does that. So it took me a while to figure this out, why so many people were having trouble. He may have since fixed this in here, but originally this didn't work. So hand type out what you see in the instructions and what you see here in order to get this working, substituting in the name for clients. You want to run the clients from localhost in most cases, and so forth. Okay.
In a real load test situation,
yes,
you'd set up this network of physical machines.
Correct.
I've actually seen our stress lab do this, and it's a little frightening, actually.
Yes, yes.
Because this box is basically poking out to a whole bunch of other boxes going, run this,
right.
And it's a little crazy.
It is kind of crazy.
It's a great tool.
Full disclosure, I've never actually set up WCAT in anger to the point where I have a controller and multiple machines generating load. I always only do a single machine generating load. I have had multiple machines generating load, but I haven't used a controller. I just go into each machine manually, run the WCAT, and just run it. Okay.
Yeah.
So now let's assume that we've done the installing WCAT's phase, so that the machine is set up for WCAT. Next, we have to go and set up a bunch of scenario files that contain the information about what type of load you want to generate. Now, for a great example of what these files look like, go to the Signaler GitHub page. Look for the Crank repository. Crank is our load testing system. And there's a folder called WCAT. Inside here are a bunch of files that you can use that demonstrate how to use setup WCAT. So essentially, you have a settings.ubr file. If we look inside this one, what we see in here is a bunch of settings. I say the current server is going to be localhost. The number of physical clients is 1. The number of virtual clients that I'm going to emulate is 1,000 for this case. I usually flip this between 1,000 and 5,000, depending on what machine I'm using to generate load. WCAT can also gather counter information, and it'll spit it out to the console while it's writing and also dump it into a log file. So I usually just leave this by default because I usually just watch the perfmon myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can also, there's a couple of registry things that I've never had to touch, so I won't even talk about them. So that's the core settings file, and then you have scenario files. So if I come back here, you'll see I've got something called basic-handler.ubr, query-string-handler, and something called shaft. So shaft, we have crank, which connects to shaft, and when flywheel connects to this thing as well, so you can see all the terminology coming in here. So shaft is a signaler endpoint in flywheel. So this scenario is going to connect WCAT to shaft, to flywheel via shaft. And if I have a look at this one, this is the one that actually sets up the requests and the scenario. So we're going to say we have a 30-second warm-up time, a duration period of 90 seconds, so the test will actually run for 90 seconds, and then we'll cool down over 30 seconds. Interestingly, what the warm-up does is it allows time for all the connections to actually establish. Mm-hmm. So if I've set this for 1,000 connections, what you'll see when you run is it divides the two numbers together and says starting one connection every 0.00047 seconds, or whatever it might be.
And from our talk earlier today, when Levi said the thread pool in the CLR, which ASP.NET uses, will only inject 2 threads per second by default.
Correct.
Don't skimp on your warm-up time.
Don't skimp on your warm-up time.
Plus, there's all the compilation, the loading of your app, the jitting happening. So
definitely don't skimp.
And you generally do an IIS reset before each run, so that always that cold warm-up time is incurred. You can set headers for the clients inside of here. I haven't had to do anything in particular. So for Signaler, I generate load to this URL. So it takes the server name, it prepends it to the URL here. And then you can also change the port if necessary. This is really difficult to find in the documentation. It took me hours and hours to figure out how to change the port to connect to. Because before your test runs, it'll actually send a ping to a different port, which is configured in a different config setting. So by default, it's port 80. If you want to connect to a different port, you have to put it inside request. So once you've done that, you can see there's a few functions you can call as well. So vclient index will give me which virtual client I am. You can even write custom functions, but it's all native code. So if you want to extend WCAT, you can. So once you've set that up, you can then go into the command line. I have a batch file here, so I can show you quickly what the batch file looks like. So this is what you actually finally run to do the thing. So in this case, I run WCAT WSF. I pass in a bunch of parameters, and you'll see that the settings.ubr file is there, and then the shaft.ubr, which is my scenario file, is there as well. And you can see I'm setting the port there as well, which is what it's going to use to do that test ping, and then I can output to a different file.
So if you're going to copy a command, that's a good one to copy. That one doesn't have
the
messed
up. Because it's in a batch file. Exactly. That one will actually work.
Dashes.
But for that initial command that you have to run on any machine you install WCAT on, look at the docs and then hand type it out.
Okay.
Otherwise, you'll end up crying.
That's fine. Okay. All right. Please defend ceiling class ABC. It doesn't really matter what class this is, right? This is just like a general question about why did you seal this? You're making my life hard.
Right.
First of all, I'm very, very sorry. Probably my fault.
Or mine.
Or yours.
I like sealing classes for whatever reason.
I'm willing to take some of that heat too, though. I mean, this is kind of a weird place to be, right? As a framework, we have to be conscious of the things that we want to support over the long term. And so sealing is a way of saying this is not intended for extensibility. But unfortunately, Philip has hit a scenario here where he's actually found a case where he didn't want to have it sealed. And so in most cases, you know, this is what I will tell Philip here, is that if he hasn't already, open a bug. Go to our CodePlex site, aspnetwebstack.codeplex.com, open a bug. Chances are we'll unseal it once we figure out what the right way to support unsealing it is. But some of it is also, I mean, these are scenarios that we seal it for your own protection. Like, we know that if you could mess with some of this stuff, we might break.
Right.
And, of course, there's always FX Cup yelling at us about attributes not being sealed.
Right.
So, but we, you know, we run FX Cup, but we liberally violate rules.
So I guess the crux it comes down to, when we build an API set, we make conscious decisions about what we, where we want to support extensibility.
Right.
Because it costs a minute. We have to support stuff.
Most of the time.
And
in this
sometimes
case,
we get it wrong.
In this case, I can honestly tell you that the chances are we just never considered whether or not this was something that we wanted people to be able to muck around with.
Right.
Although in this particular case, the filter info class only has the actual filter instance as well as the scope, perhaps, I'm thinking, or something like that. So, you know, doing custom sorting of filters could also be done from the HP action descriptor. There's a method in there called getFilterPipeline, and that's the guy that actually is responsible for assembling all of the filters in, and we're talking about web API here, just to clarify. So he's the guy responsible for assembling all of the filters together and sorting them according to their scopes as well as other rules, and removing duplicate filters for like authorization stuff. So you could potentially also extend that point to reorder the collection any way you see fit, or inject new things, or remove things, or whatever.
Just kind of a backward way of saying, related to that, a very early question about how do I do this in MVC, that's the way you do it in Web API,
which is
change the action descriptor, and then you've got control over the whole pipeline. It's actually probably quite a bit easier in Web API than it is in MVC, because there's less stuff to, less moving parts to override. But unfortunately, this is not something we can do, but, you know, Martin's suggestion of, you know, change the action descriptor might be a little ugly, but it gets you unblocked for now, and then log a bug, and we'll see about changing it in the next version.
Send a pull request if you can.
Send a pull request. Yeah, that's also that's also the good thing about being open source is, you know, if you don't like something, send a pull request and we'll evaluate it. Because honestly, you know, there's there's a lot of expense to consider when we talk about, you know, how much we have to invest in a feature or a bug. Raymond Chen has a great blog post on this. It's like, why don't you just do X? And he lists all the things that are involved with X. A PM has to write a spec, and a developer has to develop it, and a tester has to come up with a test plan.
I think
that's
Eric Lippert, maybe. But
could be, yeah, well, one of those.
Or maybe both of them.
Maybe both.
Because it's kind
And the truth is, we have a much smaller version of that, because we're not Windows.
Right.
But we still do have all that stuff. I mean, we still have to find testers to test it. We still have to find developers to develop it. So coming to us with code isn't necessarily a guarantee that we'll take it, but it certainly gives it a much higher priority that we'll take that, because, well, you already brought the code to us.
Right. Especially if it's well-tested with unit tests.
Yes, especially if it's got good unit tests.
If it's well-written, it becomes the spec.
Exactly.
Even better.
Even better.
Okay.
Another question from Philip. This is a good one for you, Damien. Do we have any way to detect a disconnected client and push stream content, which is part of Web API, other than writing to it and try catch, which seems dirty?
So we had this exact problem in SignalL. So the problem So while SignalL doesn't store state when we talk about scale out, it obviously has to store state per node so that we can do things like detect disconnect, which is what we're talking about here. And disconnect might be because the browser sent a packet to the server as part of closing the TCP connection, and then IIS notifies us. Or it may be, which is usually what happens, we try and write to the socket by calling response.write, and it explodes. And so that's generally how you find out that the client is gone. Because if you're holding onto a handle, like the request intrinsics, like we spoke about this morning, you try and write to it and it's no longer there, it'll just throw.
Right.
At which point you know it's gone. So is there a nicer way of doing that? Well, yes. So in ASP.NET, I can talk to at least, there is a property on the response object, which is client connected. That's been there for quite some time. So that allows you to poll a property before you write to it. Now, it's not guaranteed because, of course, there is a time between when you poll it and then when you actually start writing to the client. There's no lock in the world you can write that's going to make that race condition go away, because the race exists in the network card. So you have to still accept that even if you check if the client is connected before you start writing to it, some of the writes will fail. And we see this in Signaler all the time, but it's fine because we put a try-catch around it. In 4.5...
I was going to say, didn't you show something this morning about new tasks?
We have new API in 4.5 for dealing with more asynchronous coding scenarios. And one of them is an async cancellation token on the response object that represents a client being disconnected. So since IIS 7.5, the underlying native IIS modules actually provide us the ability to get asynchronously notified when the client goes away. Mm-hmm. So when the user closes their browser and the process dies, IIS can now detect that very, very quickly, assuming a graceful TCP shutdown takes place. And you can get asynchronously notified in your code via this client disconnected token as a property on the response object, and then do whatever it might be that you want to do.
Right.
So in the case of Web API, if you're hosting on ASP.NET, Brad showed this morning an example of writing a custom message handler that wraps the existing cancellation token that's passed in with his own cancellation token. So you could write a piece of middleware or a message filter for Web API that detects if it's hosting on ASP.NET, and if it is, grabs this disconnect token from the response object and then aggregates it with the existing token that was passed in, and then pumps that up to the next one. Mm-hmm. And then that would get tripped if the client goes away.
Right. So, yeah, we don't... I mean, to be clear, Marcin, who wrote the web host stuff for us in Web API, written against 4.0, so those things don't exist. So we don't actually flow them up today. We could in a future version automatically flow them up.
We probably will.
And we probably will. But until that time, we're kind of stuck.
Right.
So the message handler is a great idea, because if you know you're targeting 4.5, you can just say, hey, if HTTP context current is not null, then I'll go grab these two tokens and combine them with cancellation token source dot create linked token source, I think is what it's called.
Yep.
And then you get one cancellation token for everything, on the way up.
Yep.
The self-host situation in Web API, not so clear, because HTTP sys, I don't know what stuff we get out of the HTTP sys wrapper and how much of that's exposed in WCF, but implementing your own host could mean this detection. So IIS 7.5, just to be clear, means from a server perspective, 2008 R2,
correct.
Right?
Yeah, the Windows 7 equivalent. So the other thing to keep in mind, though, is it's not guaranteed. I mean, this is the network we're talking about.
Right, yeah, of course.
So we may never trip the token, even though the client has gone away.
Right.
Because the TCP logic is such that retries can take seconds and even minutes before they finally acknowledge that a client is gone and start tearing down the structures and the buffers and all that type of stuff. So you still need to put a try-catch around it.
Right. I just want to make a quick note to our handy typer out there. We've lost our video feed in here, so... what was I going to say about this? So right now in SignalR, you guys are sort of detecting it when you explode. I thought I remember talking to Fowler about this idea that you would start putting a heartbeat in there.
Yes.
To get a better, sort of quicker notification for these dirty...
So we have disconnect is really difficult semantically to get right. Yeah. Obviously... What we want to try and achieve is that a one disconnect and only one disconnect event will always get raised per client. That's the holy grail.
Yep.
I don't think we'll ever get there as a guaranteed thing, but we're doing more and more things to make it better. And so some of the things, we actually have a background thread that runs in your application. We literally new up a thread on your behalf in the background, and we run a whole bunch of logic every 15 to 20 seconds. And you can change your interval. And one of those logics is look at all the connections and go through and ask them, are you still connected?
Right.
Assuming IIS can tell us whether they're connected or not. And if they are, or if they aren't, we then compare the last time we saw them to some disconnect threshold. And if they're over that threshold, we raise the disconnect event. If you're in a web farm, we then also send a message to every other node in the web farm saying, hey, I've got this connection now, or I've just disconnected this connection, so you all know that I've got this connection, or you haven't.
Right.
So it's very, very difficult to get right. We're continually refining it. The other thing that we're doing is because SignalR has a client, we have JavaScript running in the client, we can also, for most transports, we actually ping basically from the server to the client. We send a heartbeat packet from the server, empty message packet to the client, which in a lot of time will force the TCP connection open, even through certain load balances and things like that.
Right.
And then in the client, one of the things we haven't done yet, but we're talking about doing, is having a client-side timer, essentially a background thread in the client, that every 5 to 10 seconds says, have I received anything from the server? Have I received my heartbeat? And if I haven't received my heartbeat, I can go forcibly push the connection into a reconnect state. Because mm-hmm. what we find is with things like transient networks, you pick up your laptop and Wi-Fi and you walk out of Wi-Fi zone. Mm-hmm. The browser doesn't know that the server has gone. And what you'll find is your AJAX request that you made just sits there indefinitely, even when you come back into a Wi-Fi zone. And so right. some of the things we're looking at is detecting that scenario via way of this client-side loop and the, mm-hmm. and the heartbeat. And yep. when it is, cancel all current traffic and forcibly reconnect to the server on your behalf.
Right. So we have an internet question from Klaus Nielsen. He asks, is manage.windowsazure.com using SignalR for real-time updates?
No.
Do you know the answer to that off the top of your head?
I do, and it's not.
Okay. But let's pretend you didn't know the answer. What's a good way somebody could figure that out?
Hit F12 to bring up your browser tools mm-hmm. and look at the network traffic.
I'm obviously look for SignalR hubs or SignalR.
Correct. So you know we have a very distinct signature in the type of request that we make. So when you first hit the site, you'll see a slash negotiate request. So we try and negotiate the transport, and then you'll see a bunch of actual sends and receives essentially mm-hmm. In the request.
Yep.
Obviously, you could look for the JavaScript files as well,
right.
assuming that they were referencing them in that way. But mm-hmm. to the best of my knowledge, it is not currently using SignalR. But who knows? That may change in time.
Right. Awesome. Let's move on to our next question here. Okay, ASP.NET Web API message handler pipeline takes care of the thrown exceptions inside of handlers, but do you think we should catch them anyway and return back a faulted task of HTTP response message inside send async? This is an interesting question. I don't know that it...
I mean, as the question itself kind of is self-answering, we take care of faulted tasks happening. All the way at the very host interface layer.
Right.
So both the ASP.NET host and the WCF host will, talk down to the pipeline, and if an exception happens, they'll catch it and return a response, at least when we're buffering.
Right.
So you don't have to do that.
Right. There's a couple points of clarification here, though, right? One is, did you throw in the method that's supposed to return a task.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, instead of returning mm-hmm. a task, you threw.
Right.
But there's also, you could, inside of something that's going to return a task, throw, and then you end up with a faulted task. And
yeah,
those right. are actually two very different things, right?
Right?
So if you throw when you're supposed to be returning a task, you're going to skip all the handlers between you and the host.
Right.
Because mm-hmm. none of those handlers probably have try catches around their call to you. Right, because they all called into you and then on the way back out. They probably don't have try catches around that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's bad. I would think returning a faulted HTTP response message is probably better.
It's just from best practices in parallel programming using the task classes. You really shouldn't be throwing exceptions from methods that return a task. You should instead be returning a faulted task. The one exception being that, if you have a null ref parameter, the very few exceptions that you put at the right. very top of your method, if someone's calling you incorrectly, that's a bad API
right.
call
right.
throw then. Otherwise,
right.
try not to throw. Now, having said that, hypothetically, if in a web API controller you were to throw an exception, we kind of have
a... okay, right?
It's okay because we have a few layers, actually, that will take care of it. First of all, we have the exception filters that will, as the async pipeline kind of goes into calling your action method and then pops back out, there's a set of filters at the very end of that that will get invoked if you threw an exception or a faulted task. I mean, we handle both cases
mm-hmm.
For you. So we'll handle it at that level, and then the HTTP dispatcher itself, I think, will also handle errors or exceptions or faulted tasks in case one of the filters threw.
Right.
And then at the very hosting layer, we will also do the same in case of any of your message handlers threw exceptions as well.
So we basically have three checkpoints.
Yes.
That yeah. we sort of catch at. The controller one's usually okay because your signature might not be task of T, right?
Right.
You may be returning customer.
Right.
Right.
And so you have to throw because, well...
It's
all you can pass back. In fact, we have an exception built into Web API that right. lets you say, you know what, my signature is customer, but I really want to give you an HTTP response message instead. It's usually used in error scenarios.
Right,
so you can
like
throw
not found or something.
Right, like a 404. How do I give a 404 back from something that returns a customer?
Interesting.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, I would say anywhere where your signature is task of T, don't throw unless... unless you have a messed up parameter that got passed to you. Mm-hmm. And in the infrastructure of Web API, that's not likely to happen.
Right. So. Now, the, yeah. I mean, and a reason why you might want to catch the exception and then convert it to a faulted task yourself is if you want to alter the way, you know, we produce the response message for that exceptional situation.
Yep.
I guess one more point to note is that, in, you know, I mentioned buffering a little earlier, but if you are writing the response straight out to the output and you've already written X number of bytes and something in your method throws because, well, you maybe you got to that iQueryable that we mentioned earlier that had has had its data context disposed of, well, at that point, the whole thing kind of just blows up because, well, we don't really know how to handle it. We've already started streaming some content out on the wire, and suddenly, you know, the world, the floor kind of
gets pulled out.
The carpet gets pulled out from under our feet, and we don't really know what to do. So try not to throw in those cases, too.
Yeah, so definitely don't throw from a formatter because that's usually what the case is going to be.
Yeah.
You know, unless you know that your formatter is buffering, and that you can sort of, you know, start over again, you're going to be kind of out of luck, so don't do that.
Right.
We have an internet question for Damien.
We do. Tim B. James asks, with SignalR being very new, what sort of support does Microsoft offer for commercial use? So SignalR is very new, and as a result, we are still in the process of bringing it in as such under the greater ASP.NET sort of web stack suite of products and suite of features. Rest assured, because it is coming in, it will get support just like everything else. So you could answer that with the same level of support that Web API or MVC or anything else that our team produces will get eventually.
I mean,
Soon. Don't call product support services today. They won't even know what it is because we haven't spoken to them
yet. It's not called that anymore. It's called CSS, which always customer support services. It always messes me up because everybody's like, CSS. I work on the web. Don't do that to me.
We're still working on it, but rest assured, by the time we release a version 1 or even, you know, a labeled release as opposed to what we're doing right now, then we'll make it very clear what the support is.
And I believe in the meantime, we have David Fowler. On Jabber 24/7 answering the any and all support
questions. I think
it's
just a bot now that says, have you read the docs? Answer.
He does not sleep.
The two
people I know I can count on to get emails at like 3 in the morning, Fowler is one of them.
Yeah, no. Absolutely. Yeah. Output caching for Web API from Eric.
So actually the question says they're looking for something like the output cache attributes available in MVC. How can we do something similar in Web API? So we prototyped something like this.
Mm-hmm.
We never actually put it in the box. I think it turns out caching is a tough problem in general, but it becomes even tougher in sort of Web API scenarios to get it right. And we felt like our prototype proved that we could write a caching layer, that people could write a caching layer, but that we didn't know enough yet about how people were going to want to do it. Because if you think about MVC, the thing that you'd be caching is HTML. Right. You're really only caching it in sort of 200 scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
In Web API, there's a lot of subtleties to the cache, like, do you want to support ETag or if modified since and things like that? Do you want to cache, you know, success cases or error cases or both? So there's a lot of unanswered questions. So we didn't put it in the box this time around, but maybe what we can do is put our prototype out in source form and see what people think about it. That might be an idea.
Right.
Yeah, we should do that.
Yeah. Awesome.
Cool. So Albion asks, implementing a persistent queue for SignalR calls from the client. Think RabbitMQ for SignalR. So the way I'm interpreting this question, and I apologize up front if I'm interpreting it wrong, but we're talking about the scenario where I have a SignalR client, so whether it be JavaScript or the .NET client or one of the other ones, talking to a SignalR endpoint. And there are scenarios over the lifetime of that connection, because we are an abstraction, whereby the connection can enter a reconnect state. There is actually no underlying transport available. And so we do queue or buffer receives from the server, whereby if you're using a transport and it goes into a reconnect state, while the client is reconnecting and thus not actually receiving data, those messages are being buffered on the server. They're being queued up. So that once that you do successfully reconnect, we will send down everything since the last message you received, because you give us back a cursor that says, hey, I got everything up until this point.
And you can do If you're in a web farm, you can store that stuff in something durable that Correct. Goes across the whole farm, because yes. you might come back against
flip-flop
a different
between
server.
Different servers. That's right. the whole point of our sort of scale-out pluggability. That's right. You yep. can plug in a different bus. But for server to client, for client to server, sorry, when you're doing sends from the client, we don't do anything like that today. Now, I do believe we've already logged an issue such that in a future release, what we will do at least is that if the connection is currently in a reconnecting state, we will not, when you call .send while it's in that state, we will buffer and queue those messages locally in the client. So in the JavaScript case, we'll literally just push them in an array, and then we'll pop them off the top when the connection comes back on. In the .NET case, we'll put them into some similar structure. But what happens at the moment is transport dependent, which is what we're trying to avoid completely in mm-hmm. Signaler. So if you're on WebSockets, for instance, that is a true full duplex connection. So if you're in the reconnect state and you try and send, it fails. Whereas with all the other transports where we use HTTP streaming or long polling for the incoming from the server, and then the client to server is all AJAX sends, even if the incoming is in a reconnect state, you can actually just call send and it'll just work, assuming the server is still up, because it's just an AJAX send. So the semantics don't match, which is what we really don't want. So we're going to fix that in a future release. We'll ensure that if the based purely on what the state property of the connection is, which you can now, since 0.52, you can look at what the state of the connection is. If it's not connected, we will buffer those sends and then okay. send them up once you're connected again.
So it sounds like the answer is we're already there, sort of, and we're getting better.
We're getting better, exactly.
Right. Good.
Okay. OData.
OData, yeah. That's,
data.
So for people who aren't familiar with what happened here, even in the release candidate of Web API, we have this feature called Queryable. It's an attribute you can apply to your controller. And if your controller then returns iQueryable of some data type, mm-hmm. we can support a very limited set of operations on that. So that's like top, skip, sort, and filter.
Right.
And even in a case of filter, a very limited set of operations for filter.
Mm-hmm.
So we got feedback from the community which said, they wanted more. And they also wanted us to sort of understand the differences between when would I use Web API and when would I use WCF data services.
Right.
So what we ended up doing is, for RTM, we ended up pulling out this queryable filter. Because we sort of made a gut check, and on two fronts. One was, you know, the users were telling us, hey, this isn't enough stuff. But any other, we have the OData team furiously working on getting a library out to do all this OData parsing for us, and we had our own parsing library,
right?
Which seemed silly in two counts, right? Give you half of it, and it's going to be
superseded.
Yeah, going to be superseded. So what we did was we pulled it out, and then we're working right now to have something available around the time of RTM that you can then plug in via a NuGet package that'll give you back queryable, but a lot more,
right?
Mm-hmm. Right? So we're not just going to limit you to those four filter stuff. We're going to have that, plus we're going to have service contracts and dollar metadata,
mm-hmm.
which is a couple of really big popular things people want to do. And the great thing about having service contracts is we'll have an endpoint that you can then point the WCF data services client at.
It'll work.
And it'll work,
nice.
Because it'll be able to detect all the controllers that are available in your web API. So now that we're getting closer and closer to WCF data services, what does that mean in terms of when you choose WCF data services versus when do you choose Web API? And I think that the answer is going to be that WCF data services is very geared towards exposing relational data, right?
The raw database.
If you have more or less the raw database tables and you have CRUD operations to go across those, WCF data services excels at that. That's what you should be using. But in our case, when you have Web API and you might have these weird data that doesn't do CRUD and doesn't really come from a database, then using the OData support in Web API might be the easier thing to do. Plus, of course, if you're already using Web API and you just want to put a couple tables out there, maybe not mixing two technologies. I mean, our technologies all do mix together really well, but you know, sometimes people like to choose one solution. So that's why we got questions earlier today about
personal choice at that point, really.
MVC versus Web API.
Right.
So we actually have a sample project. This was shown earlier when Scott Hunter's mm-hmm. demo and Dan Roth, who's the PM for Web API, demoed this. So I just want to spend
awesome
a little
places.
Time looking through it. And the idea here is, for those of you who have already seen support for this, like we have the ability to still have Queryable as an attribute get applied, although it's not popping up here. I wonder if I have the wrong version of this code. I see it commented out here, but the idea is that we'll still be able to take Queryable and apply it to your controller and still be able to automatically do the top, skip, filter, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other thing we'll be able to do is we'll be able to supply, let's see, where he put this. So for example, we have HTTP routes here. So we have an HTTP route which says if you hit $ metadata, you're going to get back the OData metadata for your web API. And if you hit, you know, just the empty URL, you're going to get back a service doc that can be used for WCF data services. And this stuff is all written as an OData metadata controller. And then, of course, they've set up links that look very much like the WCF data services style of links, where ID is in parentheses. Right, so you have a default controller with a default ID, or you have a controller with no ID, you have a controller with empty parentheses. So they've set up a few routes here. And you can see a couple of examples of, you know, here's a simple version of saying what is the EDM model for this service using just conventions where we just automatically imply things based on data annotations and entity framework. But you can also go through and actually hand create the model and say, I want to expose, you know, these products and these categories and these addresses using these exact properties. Here's the primary key. So everything's going to be extensible. So hopefully people will look at this as a nice evolution, be willing to forgive us for yanking it out of RTM, but giving it to you roughly in the RTM timeframe. But it should give you much better OData support.
Yeah. Nice. I mean, as you said, it's a lot more customizable and definitely a lot more secure, too.
Like, yep.
Just the fact that you know, in the RC version, you could just say, hey, filter this or order this collection of employees by salary, even if maybe you don't display that in your formatter, and suddenly you can see that
right.
Bob is earning more than Jane or vice versa.
Right. Yeah, it is very, you do have to be very careful with
automagical things. Yes. Kind of like MVC's overbinding problem. It's in the same vein of.
Yep.
Right.
It works beautifully, except you got to be aware that there's risks involved and you need to account for those.
Absolutely. Okay, our next question from Miguel. How can I protect a SignalR endpoint so only authorized clients can use it? So authentication, authorization, SignalR. What is the answer, Damien?
So the answer is don't authenticate via SignalR. SignalR, we delegate authentication to the host. So generally you're going to be hosting SignalR in ASP.NET, but you don't have to. You can host it in your own thing. But we flow the current principal off the thread, or the underlying host actually gives it to us when the request pipeline starts up.
Yep.
And we flow that through to your code. And so you can, in the connected event, get the, in the hubs, for instance, there's a hub context property on the hub, and that has the current user as a principal that you can get to. So
right.
you can call is in role and all those type of things as you normally would,
mm-hmm.
and that's flowed through from the underlying host. So you don't have to worry about authentication. Make sure authentication is done. By some other page in your app, generally you'll already have an existing authentication mechanism, whether it's forms auth or some open, you know, OAuth type of thing.
Right.
And you'll get a cookie created, which is HTTP only, so the client can't get hijacked from the client, all that type of thing. You know, all those things still take place.
Right.
As far as authorization, so this is where we have a hub, and perhaps there is a number of server hub methods, and you want to ensure that only certain people can call certain hub methods.
Mm-hmm.
Today you have to do that manually. So when the call comes in, the first thing you do in the hub in the method body is say, is there a current user that is authenticated, and if they are they in the role that you want to do it?
Yep.
So what we're looking to do moving forward is add support for things like filters. And so you could have code that runs before any action method or any hub method, I should say, is invoked and after it, and then it'll be very, very simple for you to create an authorization filter, very similar
right.
to what we have in MVC.
Right.
So we're looking to do that in a future version prior to version 1. So that will be there by version 1.
And we actually have a very similar situation in Web API, right? We don't have any authentication built into Web API either.
Right.
So if you want to do basic auth or IIS or whatever, we also depend on thread current principle because, much like SignalR, we're in a scenario where we don't know what the host is.
Yep.
Thread current principle is the way the .NET says, tell me who's doing this work.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, we depend on that as well.
So that's the answer.
Yeah. And our last question, just saw Dark Knight Rises. I punched myself every time something awesome happened tweeting this from the hospital. I think you ran out of characters to ask his actual question, but my Maybe. Suggestion would be to stop punching yourself.
Yeah, or go see it again and finish the job.
Yeah.
Thanks for me.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for participating today in our Ask the Experts. Hope you had a great time. And find all of us on Twitter. We're all on Twitter.
Yeah.
Damien Edwards, Brad Wilson, Martin D. And thank you very much for your time.
Cheers.